Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. And back with us now, we're so happy to have trumpeter, composer, and artistic director of the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra and Jazz at Lincoln Center as a whole, Wynton Marsalis, to talk about music in lockdown, including his upcoming virtual Jazz at Lincoln Center, Essentially Ellington High School Jazz Band Competition and Festival, which is celebrating 25 years. Hi, Wynton. So great you could make some time today. Welcome back to WNYC.
Man, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you and to be here. How you been?
Hanging in there. Can you tell us first about Quarantine Blues and how you pulled that off?
Well, Victor Goins and I were talking about technology he was using with his students at Northwestern. This was when we first went into lockdown. And he said, man, we should do a thing like this. I said, okay. And I wrote a chorus of blues and I sent it to him. And then he wrote a chorus and he sent it to Ted and Ted wrote a chorus. And then we started to send it to different members of the band. And each person wrote a chorus. We're saying it's like the virus and it's like the ideas of scientists who are working on it. And then we sent around again for each member to arrange their chorus for the orchestra. And we sent it to Todd Whitelock, our engineer, and he put it all together. And that was what it was, the Quarantine Blues.
And I really like the song, too. I happen to be a fan of composed jazz charts, not just soloing. And I really love the composition and the interaction between the sections there. Can you play live with other musicians at all on platforms like Zoom, or does the timing not sync up closely enough with the technology?
The timing doesn't sync up. Well, two people can do it if a piano player is listening to a person and just kind of following them and then compensating for the sync, the time sync, but a group like a rhythm section, no. It's difficult to do it live, so you know, with the time, with the different speed of different phones and platforms is not possible.
Yeah, that's what I figured, because, you know, I'm a jazz listener. I've actually been amazed at how much live jazz there is on multiple websites right now. But so far, everything I've seen like that is solo performance because people are isolating and those technical hurdles that you were just describing. So would you say that a music that depends so much on human interaction, as jazz does, is one of the losses for the moment from COVID-19?
Human interaction is a loss, so of course. But since so many people experience jazz on recordings, it is a loss for us, period. But like, you take the jazz musicians that many people like, they never heard them play live. And those people who love to hear live jazz musicians and all the freelance musicians, and for us who are used to playing, yes, it's a tremendous loss for us because we need that interaction with people.
Tell us about the upcoming 25th anniversary year, Essentially Ellington High School Jazz Band Competition that I see people can hear for free. What is it in normal times, and what is it this year?
Normally, we invite 15 high school bands from around the country to come compete playing music of Duke Ellington and other great composers of different eras of jazz. And we send resources to the winning band. We send clinicians out, and they come to New York, and we have a panel of judges. We call it a festival and a competition. It's more festival than competition. But we give out awards and prizes at the end. And we've had some of the greatest young musicians that are on the scene today come through this program. Now, because we have to be online, we've opened it up to be international, and we're focusing a lot more on the festival part than on the competition part. But you know, everybody wants to show their stuff and show who they are. It's going to take place this year from June 8th to 12th, and it's going to be streamed on jazz.org. And we have Zoom platforms. We're teaching classes. We're doing all kinds of different things, welcoming our alumni. We have 25 solos across 25 years where we show the best outstanding solos we've had in 25 years. And some of that stuff will bring tears to your eyes. These kids play so well, and then when you know who they were as time passed. We have a student composition winner that's going to have a masterclass for Ted Nash. We have essentially alumni at home recordings that they've done. that's going to be compiled into a concert. That will also be fantastic. We have a cheer tunnel, too, that we're going to do virtually every year when the winning bands come through Rose Hall. We all on our staff gather around and cheer for them and play New Orleans music as they come in. We're going to do that virtually. We have a virtual jam session. We've already recorded all those tracks so kids around the world can experience playing with our rhythm section. And then we have the performances, which are going to be the 18 American bands and the 5 international bands that will be on June 12th from 2 o'clock to far long after 6 o'clock.
At jazz.org. That's so exciting. How do you judge a high school jazz band in a competition? I know you said the competition part is being downplayed this year because of the circumstances, but do you have formal, you know, like formal criteria like they would for gymnastics at the Olympics or anything like that?
You definitely do. We have 5 or 6 things in our rubric. You think after 20-something years I can remember, but...
you could just like, say one.
One is you soulfulness and spirit, then balance, rhythm section balance, the swing, then soloist. How well do your soloist play? Can they negotiate through chord changes and do they know vocabulary? Then technical things, balance, intonation, dynamics, more technical things, and then a sense of form and the order of the piece, the kind of the intelligence that the bands that they play with. So those are the basic rubrics, and we have different types of judges. So we all look at different things. Like Jeff Hamilton is a longstanding judge, fantastic drummer, and he's also very funny. So I'm gonna miss sitting next to him. This guy, he makes me laugh every year. We laugh, but he focuses on drums and rhythm section. So when he's picking solos, he picks the rhythm. I focus on trumpet section and the trombones, the brass section, and we will have somebody who's an expert on reeds. They focus on. We all focus on different things.
So I guess you can stick the landing at the end of a trumpet solo like you can at the end of a backflip.
you can. It's you know, there are a lot of similarities. Just the only difference with the music is just the kind of the depth of kind of the memory you have and the depth of the understanding that you play with. But over the years, kids have gotten so much better than the first 2 or 3 years we did it. I mean, just the clarinet playing alone, then acoustic bass playing. In the first few years, we thought, man, I don't know about this. But now it's, I mean, they can play.
We have a few minutes left.
We have a lot. Go ahead. Say it again, I'm sorry.
No, you're going to finish your thoughts.
I'm sorry. We just have many more really good soloists that have vocabulary, good jazz vocabulary. They know how to play blues and understand how to play the music.
The great Wynton Marsalis with us for another few minutes. And I've been to various of your Jazz at Lincoln Center spaces, the Rose Theater, the Appel Room, Dizzy's. Appel is my favorite with the view of Central Park and 59th Street while you're watching the music. Amazing. Have you, or maybe you in conjunction with others in the music world in New York, thought yet about how you might bring live music back when the time is right in a socially distanced reconfiguration, or is that premature?
Oh yeah, we're considering it every day, talking about what other people are doing. We of course have to wait till the city opens up. We're phase 4 of the opening, so we're gonna be the last. But we have certainly. It's funny you say the Appel Room. I was just on a call with Bob Appel, and he was talking about that very. The last thing we talked about was what kind of festival are we gonna have when we open? And for arts organizations, this is budget time, so everybody's thinking about it all the time.
I want to extend my condolences before you go for your own very personal coronavirus loss. Some of our listeners know, some of our listeners may not know, that your father, Ellis Marsalis, at 85, such a great musician and educator in his own right, has passed from complications from coronavirus. Would you like to say anything about your father for our listeners who know you but not him?
He was just a great teacher, very sweet man, very good-hearted, the philosophical kind of person, very considered. He had a lot of students that he taught a lot to. And we were joking about coronavirus. I said, man, who do you think gave it to you as a joke? We didn't know he had it. And he said, what difference does it make? And then his philosophy was, if your loss of a loved one is not any more significant than anybody else's loss of a loved one. there's a tragic component to it all around. And my father also had a lot of underlying conditions. And he was very accepting. He'd not express anger, and he was also not a fearful man. So he didn't have any of the kind of fear or anger around stuff, or why me. Or he was very Eastern in his thinking, and very at peace with life and with death.
Wow. And you're a chip off the old block in being not just a great musician. You could have just been a star and everybody would have been cool with that, but you strove to become a world-class music educator as well. Young people's concerts, what Leonard Bernstein was to a previous generation, and this high school bands competition, and so much else. So Wynton Marsalis, and coming up, the Jazz at Lincoln Center, essentially Ellington High School Jazz Band Competition and Festival, which is celebrating 25 years. It'll be free for all, streaming live at jazz.org on June 8th through 12th. Wynton, great to have you on the show again. Thank you so much.
Man, it is such a pleasure to talk to you. I look forward to seeing you when we can meet again.
Absolutely. Bye-bye. We thought we would take just a few minutes now to bring on two of this program's producers to reveal a little bit of what's been happening here behind the scenes since the virus came to the tri-state area. It turns out that the experience of screening calls for the show has been different from before and reveals some things, I think, about what people are experiencing now in personal one-on-one human terms. So with me now, from their homes, are Brian Lehrer producers, Zoe Azoulay and Amina Cerna. Hi, Zoe. Hi, Amina. Usually we talk every day off the air. Thanks for stepping out from backstage for a few minutes. Hi.
Hi, Brian.
Hey, Brian.
So in March, as you well know, a lot of us had to leave the office. For a while, it was one screener at a time. There are usually three until we were able to ramp up the at-home system. Zoe, how did you notice the pandemic expressing itself on the phones?
Well, I would say one of the first things that I noticed was that all of a sudden there was no demarcation between segments in terms of what callers wanted to call in and talk about. I think we tried, like we usually do, to break up the show with various angles by asking different caller questions, but it just became clear very quickly that people were going to call in about anything and everything and just disregard the angles that we had set before us. So people would call in with health questions during an economy segment or an economy question during a mental health segment. I remember walking through the empty office and going into the studio at 9:55, and just the phones would explode. And I just have this sense of behind every blinking line, there was just this different New York story about someone experiencing this surreal pandemic in a different way that we just hadn't even begun to comprehend. So we usually have some control by the caller questions we ask. There was no control.
Because people needed to talk, and they needed to talk about the things that they were experiencing and needed
exactly.
to talk about. And so, Amina, usually callers are, in a way, examples for stories that we've already reported. But over the last few months, and I think Zoe was just indicating this, callers have led us to new stories. You have some examples of that, right?
Yeah, exactly what Zoe said. We usually kind of have this happen. We'll have a caller question and people typically stay on it, but every once in a while, like that would even happen before COVID. But during the early days, I think it was pretty clear that there was just such a lack of information on just pretty specific issues that were important to our listeners. So I remember we did a call in for the first round of people who had been laid off and were just stunned by becoming unemployed so quickly. And I screened a call that really stuck with me at that point. It was a woman who was kind of at the end of her pregnancy, and both her and her partner had been laid off because of the epidemic. So she had no idea what that meant for her birth. Her health insurance and her partner's health insurance, those were tied to their jobs. So could she even get another form of health insurance before her due date? Not to mention that at this point, nobody had any idea if it was even safe to go into a hospital. So for anything that wasn't COVID related. So should she even consider a home birth? I think we ended up picking that up as a thread. We realized we needed to examine it. And we covered that on Experts on April 2nd.
Right. Pregnancy in the time of COVID-19, that turned into a segment. Zoe, did you want to add something to that?
Yeah, I was just, you know, it's interesting. There's so many stories that reporters, you know, have to run towards. And it just became clear that obviously this is not one of them. People, reporters in our newsroom are locked in their homes like everyone else, and they can't go interview people on the street. So in some ways, our phones kind of doubled as this story hotline. And in the end of March, at least it was the first story like this to my ears, a nurse called in and said, listen to me. The story right now is there is no protective gear. My staff, we have nothing. We're reusing masks. This is the next story. You have to cover this. And I remember, I think we had Dr. Redletter on, and he was, you know, took that nurse's number off the air. But I gave that source, that caller, to the newsroom along with some other nurses who called in and said, she's right. That's the story now. And I think Gothamist and WNYC then reported that story with those sources, and they were among the first round of stories to report that PPE shortage. I mean, as you know, that was huge.
Right.
Huge
I'll never forget that segment. And in that same segment, we also heard from a very upset nurse, and this was way early. We were still broadcasting from the station and everything. And one of the nurses in that call-in, when we were just trying to get a sense of what this new disease was so fearful, you could hear it in her voice, and she said, I don't think we're going to have enough ventilators. And that was
right.
The first time that I heard that fear expressed, and it was on the show, and it was a call that you had screened. So, Amina, has the pandemic made you think of screening in a new way?
Yeah, I think that it's definitely changed, I think, the role of the screener. Typically, we just, some of our listeners might already know, we just ask, what's your name, where are you calling from, and what would you like to say on the air? But kind of one sign that really stands out to me was on May 4th when we talked about grief. And I think it's such a testament to the intimate connection that the show has with our audience. We ask people to pay tribute to somebody they've lost during COVID-19 and talk about grieving while social distancing. The lines were immediately flooded. A lot of people I spoke to at first were really overwhelmed. You got the sense that they kind of called in just spur of the moment because they were moved to call in and they didn't really know what to say. So I think a big part of screening during the pandemic has been helping people sort of process their thoughts in real time so that they can get to a concise point.
Mm-hmm.
I think in addition to Brian saying out loud, go ahead.
No, Zoe. You just cut out. I thought you were done. But I'll just say, I think a lot of us are like finding this new meaning in our phones. Like I know I am, just with my friends calling people. It's our lifeline out of our apartments, out of our isolation. And I think that's been true on the show as well. I've just been noticing that there's this connective power that we have that we've been using for good, I hope. And I will just say one example, there's so many, but one is we had someone call in and say, this was back when we didn't know if there was enough ventilators for the city. And someone called in and said, hey, I have 4 ventilators in this warehouse in Staten Island. And I think his dad was a biomedical engineer, retired. And you said, okay. And then in the next minute, Brooklyn Hospital called and said, hey, we need those ventilators. And we were able to make those connections off the air. And those ventilators got to Brooklyn Hospital. Another woman called in and said,
Zoe, you were putting all kinds of stars and asterisks and exclamation points in the caller screen box. This guy has ventilators.
It's like this. People don't know there's just this little text box that the screeners can convey this information to Brian, and he's doing so many things that you have to be very judicious with your language, and the asterisks and the exclamations do a lot of work. A woman called in and said, I don't have any water to wash my hands. My landlord won't give it to me. And you said, tenant lawyers, can anyone help her? And the next minute, a tenant lawyer called in. I mean, it's really, people need help, but people also want to help. And those are the connections that I want to make and I enjoy making, and we all do.
Amina, yeah. Last word there. I know you have thoughts on the callers and lifelines, too.
Yes. We do get a sense that our call number is sort of a lifeline for people who share how they're kind of at the end of their rope. When I get on the phone with people who want to speak to a city official like the mayor on Ask the Mayor segment or the city council speaker, you can really hear how exasperated people are. And I think at a time when the city's channels of communications are very clearly backed up and overwhelmed, our listeners know that we can make those connections for them. So
I want to thank Amina Serna and Zoe Azoulay, two of our producers who have been experiencing a lot of the public emotion and really the personal emotion and needs and thoughts and feelings and compassion and intellect and everything of our listeners, of people who've been calling in to this show in the COVID-19 pandemic. It's not just Zoe and Amina. They rotate through this job each day. Our other producers, Mary Croak and Lisa Allison and Ryan Wild, who's been filling in on an interim basis. And our interns do this too. Griffin Fuchs and Anderson Calderon and Ben Rubin have also been on the receiving end of all this information and context and emotion, and frankly, at a time when so many people have to stay so disconnected from each other, this has been a source of connection, both for you and for our screeners who are isolating like everybody else, but getting to talk to so many people who they don't even know. And it's one of, I think, the gratifying parts of the job, but also one of the really challenging parts of the job in a period where everything is so intense. So Zoe and Amina, thanks for coming on. Thanks for representing your colleagues too. And I'll talk to you in the post-show meeting at 12 o'clock.
All right. Talk to you on Zoom, Brian.
Thanks. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And now a segment about how isolation and stay-at-home orders are affecting our sense of time. Since this all started, have you noticed that time feels different? That the days seem to stretch or lag, or maybe they zoom by with startling speed? That your internal clock is signaling, I'm confused. You're not alone. People around the world in various levels of COVID-19 lockdown are reporting a distorted sense of time. We're going to talk about why that would be with a time philosopher. And a bit later in the segment, we'll hear from a researcher who is collecting time perception data in a national survey. With me now is Adrian Barden, a professor of philosophy at Wake Forest University and author of the book, A Brief History of the Philosophy of Time. Dr. Barden, welcome to WNYC. Thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for having me.
So here's a line I've been hearing. The pandemic feels like it's going on forever, but the days are zooming by. Why would that be?
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you study subjective time experience, and you see it in its complexity, it's not surprising to have this very confusing sort of temporal disorientation under these kinds of conditions. The first thing I'd say, so two things. First thing I'd say is that there's no such thing as one internal clock that we have. The brain is running all kinds of different systems at the same time that performing different functions that could each be described as an internal clock or affect our subjective experience of time. We're constantly synchronizing our sensory inputs, like our visual and auditory inputs. We're regulating and directing attention. We're integrating our memories into making plans. And then we have other systems for regulating our bodily functions, like our sleeping and waking cycle. So it's more like we have a bunch of internal clocks, all of which are performing different functions. The second thing is I'd also distinguish, now this more direct with your point, I distinguish between our experience of the duration of events as they are happening and our retrospective judgments as to the passage of time or how long a period of time seemed to have taken. So when we're stressed out and anxious and out of our routine, the day seems to drag by. When we look back on a day when nothing much happened and we weren't productive, it seems like, well, we don't know where the time went. What happened? You know, that can happen to a whole month. I mean, what happened to April? I was stunned actually when April came to an end personally. It's because it's, you know, we weren't productive. When you look back and you weren't productive, it seems like the time flew by. But while you were living it, time was dragging by because of the negative emotion and the kind of attention you were paying to what's going on around you.
That's an interesting dichotomy. So, listeners, we could take some phone calls. How have you been experiencing time during the pandemic? Does it feel like it's been going on forever, but the days are zipping by? Does it feel like it's always Monday? Today is Monday, by the way. Or do you wonder where the day has gone? Or is time going by incredibly slowly, like the morning creeps by and the days are going on forever? 646-435-7280. Obviously, this is mostly for people who are working from home or unemployed at home. How does time feel different than it did at the office? Do the days pass differently? Or if you're out doing essential work, this could be for you too. Tell us if time is getting weird for you too, if you're going out and still doing essential work outside the home. What is that doing to your sense of time? Maybe it's going faster because there's so much to do, or slower because the work is so stressful. Call in and tell us about your sense of time as the pandemic rolls on. 646-435-7280. 646-435-7280. For Adrian Barden, a professor of philosophy and author of a book. It's not A Brief History of Time. That's somebody else's book. A Brief History of the Philosophy of Time. So, Dr. Barden, in time perception terminology, I see there's something called flow. What is flow, and why would it be disrupted?
Well, okay. Yeah, that's right. That's right on point. That's right. So the subjective experience of time has mainly to do with attention. But there's different types of attention, and this has to do with your circumstances and your emotional context. So the main distinction here is between outward directed attention and inward directed. So when you're experiencing relaxed, engaged, outward directed attention towards some project you're working on at work, at play, you're doing hobbies, you're exercising, that's when people report that time flies. Or when you're being interviewed for a radio program. So that's called flow. And now this pandemic situation is a kind of perfect storm for breaking you out of flow and sparking a very different kind of attention, a kind of negative inward directed attention. When you're experiencing psychological stress, anxiety, and as you were saying, this is mainly applies to people who are sheltering in place, as opposed to necessarily being out there and being extremely busy. When you're living under stress, anxiety, distraction, it's really much harder to lose yourself in these outward-directed activities. And given the negative emotional context, you might start experiencing repetitive, negative, inward-directed thoughts about yourself and about your situation. So this is the opposite of flow. This is called rumination, you know, like cows chewing over their cud, their ruminants. So you're chewing over your problems and chewing over your situation. And so this kind of attention is heavily associated with subjective reports of time going by slowly.
Also with us now for a few minutes is Dr. Philip Gable, Director of Experimental Programs at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He's been given a grant to administer a national survey collecting data on how people are perceiving time now. Hi, Dr. Gable, and welcome to WNYC.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It seems like you started this project soon after lockdown measures started. When did you realize this is going to affect how people perceive time, and what questions are you asking?
Right, so we've been studying time perception in the laboratory for many years now, and this situation very clearly is going to have probably one of the most profound social psychological influences in at least in my lifetime, perhaps. And we knew that this was going to have a profound influence on how people experience time passing, because we investigate the perception of time being influenced by emotion. And we found that emotion has a profound influence on the way time's passing. And so we knew that obviously this is a strong emotional situation, so this is going to have an influence in that way.
So are you finding distinctions in time perception between people who are working from home or unemployed at home versus those essential workers going to work every day outside?
We haven't been looking at their work, like what they're actually been doing. What we did find, this is in a sample across about 1,000 participants across the United States, was that the emotions that people were experiencing were the strongest predictors of how they felt time either sped up or slowed down. Those, about half of the people that we surveyed, experienced time slowing down, and the strongest predictor of that seemed to be whether they were experiencing negative emotions like worry, anxiety, fear, uncertainty. About one quarter of the participants actually had the opposite, where time was seemed to fly by, move a little faster. And that was the strongest relationship predicting that was whether people were experiencing positive emotions like feeling content or maybe even being gladdened over the past month.
And are you finding any demographic differences, like how men and women perceive time at similar different rates, or any other demographic differences?
There was a slight finding where men seem to experience time moving a little bit faster than women do. Not 100% sure why that's occurring. I mean, it could be that women are maybe experiencing a little bit more worry, anxiety, than the men in our sample were. But that's something that we're going to have to dig down a little bit deeper to try to understand a little bit more.
All right. Early results from the National mm-hmm. Survey on Time during the pandemic with Dr. Philip Gable, Director of Experimental Programs at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Thank you so much for a few minutes of your time. It went by really fast. And we're going to continue in a minute as we start to take your calls on how time is getting weird during the pandemic with Dr. Barden staying with us. Stay with us yourself. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we talk about how your life in the pandemic in your life in the pandemic, you know, it's all messing with your sense of time. Adrian Barden is our guest, professor of philosophy at Wake Forest and author of A Brief History of the Philosophy of Time. And Tess in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tess.
Hi, Brian. I love your show, longtime listener.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, this is a great segment because something happened to me last week where I had come from home from work and I had spoken to a girlfriend of mine, washed my hair and fell asleep for about an hour, looked at my phone and it was 8 o'clock and I thought it was 8 o'clock in the morning. I called an Uber, rushed on my way to work, and consequently realized actually it was 8 o'clock at night that day.
And do you think that was pandemic related somehow?
I do think that because I just have been going to work and then going home and not really doing anything else.
Uh-huh.
And so it feels like the days are sort of merging themselves into uh-huh. each other.
That's so interesting. So even going out and working outside the home, if there's lockdown the rest of the time and you're just working and sleeping, the days and the hours can run together. Lydia in Washington Heights, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lydia.
Hi, Brian. Thank you so much for this wonderful show and everything you're doing for New York City right now.
Thank you. And you had an experience with time, too?
Yes. Don't we all these days? I was part of the cohort of customer experience workers laid off abruptly from Everlane in March after we reached a majority support for our union. And this was quite a traumatic experience for all of us. And my question for your guest is if he could say a little bit more about how our feelings of grief right now are also affecting our perception of time. And for those of us who have been laid off, but also those of us who are experiencing grief for family members who have been affected by this pandemic, or even just the low-level feelings of grief that I'm sure we're all experiencing for
life
our
as
former
we knew
way
it,
of
right?
life.
Yeah.
And
Lydia, let me get an answer because our time is short. And we have several callers who are bringing up differences in their perceptions of time after recently losing a loved one. So I'm sure that's something you've looked at before the pandemic, how grief affects our sense of time, Dr. Barton, and then Lydia generalizing that to grief for our previous lives.
Well, it's interesting that your caller brings this up, and I appreciate that comment. I've actually had this conversation with my students. I've been teaching my college classes online ever since spring break, and they've been looking a little bit grim and not very happy with things, and very dislocated, very out of their routine. And I was trying to stress to them that there's two ways to think about sadness, and one is to sort of like turn it on yourself and say, well, I'm depressed. I'm dealing with this the wrong way. And that's a feeling that is actually quite heavily associated with people experiencing temporal disorientation, people with clinical depression, or people who are in a state, temporary state of depression. But that I wanted to really distinguish that for them from grief, which really, when you think about it, is more, or should be thought of more as kind of outward directed. If you're experiencing grief, it's because the world has let you down. It's not because you've let yourself down. The thing to think about there, and I don't know how easy it is to follow this kind of advice, is to think, well, how can I respond to what's going on in the world in a constructive way? Using your grief in a constructive, productive way. And that's a way of maybe trying to turn your attention outward and away from yourself and beating up on yourself. So that's a discussion I was just having with my students.
Lindsay in White Plains, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I just wanted to point out that for American Muslims, it's been Ramadan for almost a month now, and fasting for 16 hours a day is rough when you're not at home, but especially while you're just sitting at home trying to pass the time.
We're going to do an end of Ramadan segment on Friday, by the way, just something to look forward to.
Oh, fantastic. I wanted to comment that for men who are used to being more at work, and obviously women are at work too, but for moms who are staying home and fasting, that's their life always. And so men who are now at home more are actually observing that, wow, it's really difficult to be hanging out by the fridge and dealing with kids for 16 hours a day and fasting. So it's brought a new sort of interesting perspective, passing the time fasting for the.
Yeah, that's a good one. Men in Ramadan experiencing time more similarly to women in many cases than in the past. David in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hey, how are you? Good morning, everyone. My question for the experts, Brian, is this. Have they looked into the issue of how time either flies or doesn't while you're reading during these times of COVID? I know
Has
a lot
that changed
of us thought,
for you
wow.
in some way?
Yes, I remember being very excited. I'm finally going to read War and Peace. And what used to, the pages would flip by, even with a thriller. And now I find the concentration is harder. And what I think has been minutes has actually been maybe a half an hour, and I've gone through two pages. And I'm wondering if the experts have a view on whether this is related to the issue of time or whether it's just a product of productivity while one is in COVID lockdown.
Dr. Barton, have you ever heard of this one before?
Well, it's like any other activity you're engaged in, and it's different for each person. It, you know, if it's an activity that you find engaging and you can lose yourself in it, then you're going to have this experience of time passing by. I think in the larger context here, I think it would be really helpful if we, you know, collectively as a society felt more responsibility and more engagement with being able to react, you know, proactively to this crisis, as opposed to just being asked to shelter in place, because it would encourage more of that kind of positive,
like to
engagement.
Volunteer and stuff.
Volunteer work, you know, famously during the Blitz in World War II, you didn't see that mass panic in London from the bombing because everyone was working on shelters, fire brigades,
so
safety patrols, food supplies.
And guess what? Time is something that we are now out of for this conversation, which has not only been intellectually interesting, but like with your last answer and with some of the callers, I think really useful for people. So thank you so much. Adrian Barden, author of A Brief History of the Philosophy of Time. Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.